Welcome to Polycast, the civilization podcast focused on game strategy. Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Vian Team.
Ed Jin.
With guest co-host,
Lord Perkin.
So this is live streamed now. It's sort of been about 6 years or something, so I'm sort of catching up with the times.
It really has been, hasn't it? Jeez, oh, think about how long that's been. Yeah, we do it live now.
No going back and cutting things out.
Well, there is post-editing. Dan does edit out stuff, but there will be a certain live audience that will hear what you say live regardless, so yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome, everybody. This is Lord Parkin here. I'm welcoming you to episode 249. I'm here today with Dan Q.
When there's something strange popping out on your screen, who are you going to curse? Your mama!
Also here with the Mian Team.
Saying stupid things.
Makalua.
I require more coffee.
And Med.
I need more coffee. The question is, what is the best utility pantheon? And by definition of utility pantheon, it's the question.
It's best utility pantheonons.
Well, okay, fine. I'll just assume that he misspelled that. Considering he wrote pantheon properly like twice in a couple
words
after that. Whatever.
The third title is Pantheonons, and I want to found a Pantheonon.
Anyways, so the definition of utility Pantheon we're going with on this one is no faith, because you can't get faith out of it, so just assume you're not doing any faith-based religion stuff. But what is the best one that will give you other bonuses that is useful?
Yeah, so that takes away those that give you faith only, but also those that give you faith along with something else as well.
Yeah.
So you're cutting out about eight of them?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. That many.
Yeah. All right. And it also assumes that we will found a religion via alternate means. So there will be a religion. So it's not utility as in you're just going to take the pantheon and then ignore religion altogether, but you're going to actually found one. So it'll be part of your religion regardless. Starts with favorite of gods of craftsmen, so extra hammer. This looks like a crappy boost, but it is, but, you know, he likes some hammers early game, which I guess is okay, but there's better hammer ones than gods of craftsmen.
Yeah.
Yeah, sadly, I have to agree with Medjin. I mean, I agree, yes.
I agree. If you're going for hammers, there are better ones. Then he goes for messenger of the gods, two extra science per city connected via road. Of course, Mackie's favorite.
I was about to say, that's the only reason that's on the list, because...
Yeah, totally Mackie's favorite.
Trying to get a Mackie's good graces.
I mean, Grant,
I don't like that one.
If you are Carthage, then you definitely go for Messenger of the Gods, because Carthage, auto-connections, very nice. Otherwise, yeah, you kind of have to spam wide for that one to be really, really good.
Yeah.
I mean, two base per city, if you only go for four cities, that's an entire eight. And the question is, do you apply to all the bonuses, or is it after the bonuses? Interesting question. And even if it is, you'd have to get to over 100% increase before that two becomes three and four. So, yeah, it's not very big.
Well, 50% would put it to three, right? I mean, that's still kind of...
You'd hope, but there's probably some rounding in there.
Probably.
And, of course, he throws in fertility rates, 10% growth rate bonus. Woohoo! Or not. That one got ripped out right on the very next.
Yes, it did.
The very next post just disappeared. I mean, growth rate bonuses are good if you have, like, full food rolling and lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of food.
Yeah, but you're almost always going to get more growth for the entirety of the game that matters from an alternative pantheon.
I have taken it from time to time, but only when I've got absolutely no resources of any significance that are going to get benefit from other stuff, like fate or culture or production bonuses, for instance. So, yeah.
And then, of course, you mentioned God King, but for OCC only, but it's strong. I'm not sure if it's OCC only.
No, it isn't. Although it's definitely more appealing there because you're less likely to have enough resources to make other things beat it out.
It does have a limit on how good those plus one of everything gets to eventually.
It also shouldn't be listed here because it gives you faith, doesn't it? So technically, it shouldn't be there.
That is true, yeah, because the palace provides plus one to Yield's faith, so.
Yeah, he's breaking his own internal consistency.
No.
So, yeah, we mentioned fertility rates. Yeah, I already mentioned, yeah, the plus 10% growth rate, Mr. Messenger to God. Oh, yeah, and the gods of Krasen was plus one production in cities with populations of 3+.
Yeah.
Magin mentioned, I think there's better production ones out there. And, yeah, I'm looking at you, God of the Sea, plus one production from fishing boats. Yes, okay, assuming that you actually have access to resources that you can improve on the water. Claude Diem is like, I do not recommend having biases towards any pantheon because they're very terrain dependent. Okay, yes, I treat this as all else being equal.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you can get ridiculous amounts of food from Sun God or, like, much more rarely Goddess of the Hunt.
Mm-hmm.
That makes it really strong, like, more attractive than most of your possible alternatives if you can get a religion.
Yeah,
I mean, well, I've had upwards of, like, 8 total food or 10 total food from Goddess of the Hunt with 6 of that in my capital. That was a really exceptional game with, like, fur and deer. But still, when you have that kind of situation, it becomes a really strong... Really strong pantheon.
I had that in my last game, that Goddess of the Hunt. It's just amazing when you've got a deer staff and deer all around you.
Well, that's the problem is so many of the pantheons are actually very map specific.
Yeah.
So if they exist, then that pantheon's utility just skyrockets. If they don't exist, well, it's zero.
Yeah. The case with all these things is like, what thing is best? And it's like, well, it depends. It's like, what map have you got?
Yeah.
One that I'd add that wasn't mentioned is God of the Open Sky, the plus one culture from Pastures, which I have actually used on one or two games, which can be nice if you've got a bit of cattle or sheep or something around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. As the thread goes on, people start talking about type of yield to get, and culture comes up pretty quick. Early culture is big culture. Even if you're going tradition, and you're just going for 4 cities, but you have, say, 5 or 6 pastures within your range of those 4 cities, then, yeah, that faster tradition finished.
Yeah, speed up your policies there. The other one I have noted down here that I might pick occasionally is the oral tradition, the plus one culture from plantations, which can be all right, I guess, but usually you'd pick something else.
Yeah, I got that on my short list as well, oral tradition.
Again, if you have lots of plantations in the neighborhood.
Exactly. It all depends on the resources.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly, if you got lots of jungle around, and part of me's thinking, oh, I'm sorry, but at the same time, Sacred Path plus one culture from jungle tiles, that can be very valuable. Like, if I'm going to exclude faith entirely, as is the setup for this, and even if faith is in play, sometimes I will be like, oh, I would like something that's more food-based, depending upon my terrain, although often I am looking for something that is faith-based, seeing as how a pantheon is tied to faith towards the ultimate, hopefully being able to go ahead and found a religion. But then after food would come culture, and then to me after culture, again, all else being equal, I start looking for happiness ones. Not that there are that many, but for example, Goddess of Love, plus one happiness from cities with a population of 6+. And then there's also, where's the river one? Plus one, from cities on rivers, the sacred waters.
Even gardens. Okay.
I think the only ones that I really would never consider are a lot of the defensive ones. Defensive bonus.
Goddess of Protection!
Excuse me. The AI takes it for you right off the mark. Don't worry. You never have to take it. The AI always takes that one first. That is so broken. In what situations, say the jungle side, Sun God versus culture from all tiles, if you know you're going to have a ton of jungle and maybe you're going to settle more than just your capital in jungle, at what point do you say Sun God isn't worth it versus culture from all the jungle? Obviously, Sun God gets you started early because, frankly, crappy jungle is just crappy. So extra food is good. But long game, I think culture from the jungle is better because you're going to TP all that jungle anyways.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't usually prioritize that one because, yeah, I think in the long term, not going to be keeping around a lot of that jungle. So.
Well, I don't know. I mean, if your jungle start, you just TP all the jungle, and that's a crap ton of science.
On top of the culture that you're then getting from. Yeah, and it's not like plus one culture from worked jungle tiles, which would be so sad. That's an important qualification there.
Yeah, the thing is, there's just so many pantheons that you're never really struggling for getting those sort of bottom-of-the-barrel ones. Usually you can get something that's at least halfway decent, so you're not too concerned about those ones.
On a huge map, the pantheon cap goes up, doesn't it?
Yeah, maybe then you'd have a bit of a competition, especially if they were human players.
Yeah, you want to be checking that counter if you haven't found out your pantheon yet. So, how much faith do I need now for a pantheon, now that this one went? Thank you. Not.
Yeah, at some point you just be like, yeah, nope.
Scraping the bottle of the barrel, to me, regardless of situation, in addition to Goddess of Protection, religious settlements, plus 15% faster border growth.
Woo.
I'm not saying there aren't times where it can be useful, but boy, oh boy, I really have to dig deep, especially when it's, you're choosing this over something else as well. Plus, if I really want faster border growth, which certainly can be helpful in acquiring tiles and not having to buy it, there is this thing called Tradition Opener, which is, tradition is helpful otherwise for food, but also, hey, look at this, I can already acquire tiles more quickly. And I can hear some people say, well, yeah, and then if you did religious settlements, then you can
really does it
multiplies on top of each other, but it's like, can you really work that stuff that much more quickly on top of what else you're giving up? Like, no.
It would have to be a situation where there's literally no terrain dependent pantheon that's useful.
Yeah,
literally
none. Pretty much, because maybe I'll buy on average one, maybe two tiles per city throughout the game, but for the most part, the water's expanded about the rate that I need anyway, and usually in the right direction, so I'm not usually too concerned about it.
There are some times where I wind up buying tiles if I'm not going tradition. I like cherry tapping with honor a lot in RMP games, so it becomes an actual consideration if you're not going tradition. Sometimes,
yeah.
But I would still guess, never take that pantheon. Even then.
Yeah. You can probably guess which social policy tree I usually go with then.
Yeah. Although that does make a point. If you're going to go piety. Sorry.
Oh, God.
That's it.
Okay.
Gotta go piety.
Then the culture choices actually really push harder. So anything that gets you mass culture, because then you can actually get through piety faster rather than face.
I think it's more of like a sort of single player variant thing with piety that just doesn't seem anywhere near as strong as the rest.
Well, yeah, but if you're going to waste your time going piety first, and you're not like Pantheon, because you have to, then why not go mass culture?
I guess not.
And the last utility pantheon that we have not yet discussed, and it's the one that's on the list that I immediately think of, I have one question for you in response if you're thinking of taking this, and that question is, are you Egypt? Monument to the Gods, plus 50% production on ancient and classical wonders, because you already have a production bonus for that wonder construction. But still at the same time, if your answer is yes, I'm not necessarily going to then say, yes, go ahead and take that, just because you are Egypt. But to me, if you're not even Egypt, or maybe you're playing on a lower difficulty level, say Prince or lower, then maybe, if you just kind of want to mess around with it. But it too is so situational. I mean, hey, it's better than Goddess of Protection, but I don't know how much that's really saying.
But, I mean, it's an additive bonus as well. That is plus 15%. It's not multiplied by 15%. So Egypt's actually, relatively speaking, it's getting a lower ratio of increase in production. So it's arguably less useful for Egypt, I would say. Not that it's really that seems that useful for any of them. I mean, if it was for all wonders throughout the game, then sure. But just for ancient and classical? Nah.
I mean, you can really try to speed your way through the Great Library. Never mind. I mean, there are some good classical level ones that would be very useful to get quick. And also keeping in mind, it also covers into national wonders. So there's lots in there that you would want to spam quickly if you can.
Oh, we didn't acknowledge you started this thread.
Yep.
The third topic on the show in a couple of episodes. I swear they're not paying me. By the way, your last check bounced. No. WR. We're not even going to try to pronounce their actual username. I know it's Imagine just completely probably didn't even want to attempt it at all, so I'll abbreviate it. I'll take the heat. Mm-hmm. I can take it.
Okay.
I'm a bit confused about his using of the word utility, though. I don't quite understand. Why didn't he just say non-faith?
Well,
it's... I mean, aren't they all utility? I don't know.
He wanted to figure out what's the most useful. Well, I mean, utility has a good definition when it comes to what's useful.
I suppose.
Things have
but that would be like, utility. Which ones provide the highest utility, not the highest utility pantheon.
Yeah.
The usage has different meanings in those two sentences.
And when I saw utility, I thought, oh, you're talking about something that's perhaps more practical. So, for example, you're going to found a pantheon that's based on food that I could actually physically touch and manipulate, as opposed to faith, which is just this concept that's out there.
I'm pretty sure they're both just five concepts, and you can't actually touch either of them, Dan.
Can't actually touch food? That's a Civilization V concept? Oh, man. That's scary.
Totally.
Thread started by Gobbledygook. Domination without ranged units. Normally when we talk about domination victories, we consider a few timings, like composite bow, crossbow, cannons, artillery, bombers. Now it's well established that CB and XB Rush are some of the most powerful forces you can build against the AI. But if you wanted to play with a UA like Minutemen Samurai Berserkers, how would you do it? Is a mass melee with siege support playstyle viable against Immortal and Deity? I do take some exception to saying siege support, because sieges are ranged units. They are inferior for killing units to crossbows and whatnot, but you can still kill units with siege, and they still shoot you.
I don't know, Phil, did you contribute to this thread before we started talking about it on the show?
Yeah, maybe a little.
Maybe a little. Well, I said that's the funny thing, because he mentions cannons, artilleries, and bombers in the first line, and then says without those.
I think he just wants to see catapults and trebuchets used, maybe, but yeah, it's not like you can't do it at all, but...
Got to win by weight of numbers or superior technology or a combination of both, just sort of throw meat at them until they sort of cave in.
Yeah, usually it's a superior tech thing, or you can use strong mounted units like the Songhai Cavalry to just like hit the enemy, then back off, and then hit the enemy with another one and back off, and then you kill them, and then you just keep doing that until they're out of units, and then you can keep going. But it's a lot slower than using ranged.
Well, I guess it comes down to, did they put in a wall or a castle first? Are they on a hill?
Yeah.
If they don't have a hill, then early game cities are really weak compared to swords.
Yeah.
Say, even if they get in wall, it's not that much higher than a base swordsman. And if one of your first upgrades for your swords happens to be siege for an extra 50% attack, then all of a sudden your combat strength is still sufficiently higher, which means if you can attack it with three or more melee units per turn, you can do some pretty serious damage.
Yeah.
And not actually lose
there.
Everybody.
Yeah, it's really useful as Iroquois, since you know you can make the swords.
Yeah.
One of the few things that's useful with that, Civ. So,
but it even flows into longswords and muskets, and entirely comes down to, did you take siege on your melee unit, in which case your melee unit's now actually going to be that much more stronger.
The problem is you still have to get rid of their army somehow.
Well, you assume that you just run them over.
if you're taking siege on your swordsmen, and they have, like, 10, 15 units, unless you're playing on Marathon, even if you can run them over, it's going to take some time to chew through all the garbage.
Oh, yeah. I would assume that you're not actually attacking somebody's city without killing their units in front of it first.
But that's why crossbows are so much better. Like, you can take a city with almost anything if there's no units around.
Well, no.
If you completely wipe their units or just attack a city without units, I would probably bring trebuchets and catapults in the first place, because they're better against cities.
Yeah.
Well, I think that part and parcel with having mounted units, like, okay, well, I'm going to use the mounted units to start clearing the units around the city so I can actually get to the city with melee. Also a degree of how many am I going to need? Do I have enough? Which cities am I going to attack? Again, based on if you have walls or hills, as Madjin was getting at. You can go in stages. It's like, okay, I'm not going to be able to take the city with this melee unit right now because of that city strength over here, but I can take this one and I can cut myself into their empire and then start building that as more of a front to then say, okay, now I've got more cities, so now I got more production, I'm getting more science, more food, back to the science, improve my science, and be able to upgrade my melee units, so now I can go in, say, beyond the iron consideration, oh, I don't have enough sources of iron. Okay, well, then maybe at that point, it's, okay, I'm going to have one wave of melee units that surround, and they do an initial attack, and then I swap them out with another melee unit that's right behind on the next turn, have that one heal, maybe pillage, back off a little bit, then hit it again. So it's all these questions of what units do you have, what technology area are you at, how many hexes are you going to be able to surround the city? And, of course, we haven't even gotten into considerations of melee units on the water as well.
Yeah.
Potentially providing support.
You know what, though? We are talking Immortal and Deity here. I'm just throwing that out there. And while good players can still easily out-tech, especially Immortal, but even Deity, it's one of those situations where they will have a lot of trash. Like, a lot of trash that you have to swat through. And yes, you can win. You can win these wars. You can kill their units and lose nothing, even with melee. If you're careful about it and if you're managing the terrain well, you can kill units without losing units. But the problem comes in is that this just takes so frickin' long, and you're leaving resources on the table, because if you could take the cities faster, if you could kill their units faster, you make more progress, which is the point of declaring the war in the first place as opposed to doing something else. So yes, you can do it, but it bothers me that it's so suboptimal for most civs.
No, I agree. I would never take this as an approach. Let's do this because it's the best strategy, but
it's like a challenge.
Okay, another way to look at the game, if I completely remove without range units, how else could I do this? When could I do this? Why would I want to do this? Which then also helps us look a little bit at just how strong and how much do we rely, whether that's good or bad, do we rely on range units?
Oh, wait.
It would be so much better if we actually put range units back into the equation. It's a bit academic, but it's also a bit practical.
Wait a minute. There's a way. There's a really good way. Do nukes count as range units? I'm pretty sure they're their own class, right? So
totally.
Here's what you do. You tech to XCOMs and nukes, and then you nuke every capital and drop 6 XCOMs surrounding it. And then you take all the capitals and you win domination.
Oh,
there you go. Domination without range units.
Nukes would be a superior way of taking care of all this trash you're talking about.
There's still all the stuff with nukes and then lock in with a non-range unit.
Yep.
Domination without range. Yes.
Scout plus nukes.
Well, I enjoyed actually how the conversation came up about you should wait until later. How dare you wait until later? You should be able to do this earlier in the game. So how would you do it earlier in the game? And it's like, okay, so you set up this qualification and other people jump in and say, no, we need to hamstring your choices even more. You cannot wait until it is optimal without range units. You must be able to do it earlier. Are you going to do it with musketmen? No, I want to wait for Great War Infantry. No, that's still too late. How are you going to be able to do it with swordsmen? And it's like, okay, wow, guys. What are you doing to yourself?
Well, like Matt said, you can take some cities with swordsmen. You're probably not going to win Immortal or Deity domination on standard-sized maps using swordsmen alone, though. But you can take cities that way.
I took domination without range units, not as in complete domination, get the domination victory, but can you make progress towards dominating through domination of parts of civs, even multiple parts of different civs without range units? Yes, you can.
Two things. One, he is actually talking about domination victories. That's right there in the first line. And two, feels more correct than most things because you know how many melee units you would have to make to get past the Immortal and Deity spam? You would break your economy trying to spam units to be able to keep up with that. So, yeah, utility-wise, not so much.
Oh, yeah, Goblin does talk about it in the context of a domination victory and being on Immortal and Deity. He talks about how would you do it, and it's like, well, I don't think that's the proper question. It's how could you do it? I still don't know why you would want to do it, but then when people started adding all these qualifications afterwards about, no, you must be able to do it earlier, no, you can't use this, no, you can't use that. So it's like, fine, how would you do it? I would take the approach of domination, not towards how are you going to actually achieve a domination victory without ranged units outright, but how can you work towards a domination victory? So, yes, I kind of changed the qualification a little bit, but I tried to make it a bit more practically speaking. I was trying to help Gobbledygook in his question.
Part of it is he's really talking, can you use catapults and trebuchets with melee to do damage early game? That's really what it pops up to.
You want to be able to do a significant damage to the city that you are attacking without doing comparably negative damage to your melee unit, and to be able to do as much of that as possible in one turn, or at most two turns, lest you then get bombarded or otherwise squished to death subsequently. Congratulations, you got it down into the yellow, but you don't get points for partially being able to take the city.
Nope.
You needed to get it into the red and out of the red, as in you are now in the city and it is yours.
You're not getting it taken back a second later. One thing that helps with style, by the way, is you can pick marathon speed, which is a tremendous advantage because your ability to kill units without losing units is magnified because you have more time to heal and the AI has less time to rebuild units. So if you're not losing stuff, that tends to be more favorable because you get a lot of time.
Also tech base. You're not going to see the next unit pop up 10 turns later.
Yeah, there's that as well. You just get more time to do everything with unit manipulation. And since the human players who are actually playing on Immortal Deity are way better than AI at that, typically, it's a pretty big advantage.
As for using artillery, everybody keeps talking about, oh, they just get the flight and wipe out all your artillery. Well, generally true. But has anybody considered putting up anti-aircraft around those artillery?
In most games, we go so fast past that we kind of ignore the fact there is an anti-air in there.
Yeah, it's usually the point. It's like, there's an anti-aircraft?
Yeah.
Isn't that called a fighter?
Yeah.
Even that. What's a fighter? I got bombers.
Well, if you're running, like, multiple range logistics already, then fighters are fine. Just cover those. You're good.
But even still, can you just slap in a bunch of AA?
Yeah.
And then use those for melee too, because AA is very freaking strong for a melee unit. It's about the same as the infantry.
I think Madge's just about to hit the nail on the head here. That's really what this thread was about, was to promote anti-aircraft.
Exactly. Yes. AA units.
Clearly.
It's the pro-anti-aircraft coalition. It's PAC. Ah, it's a PAC thread.
Another PAC thread. Man, we just get these all the time.
A different pre-agriculture era. This thread brought to us by Dunk Leostosis. Dunk. There we go. Yeah.
That's Dunk.
He said, separate from what I see with mods, I would like to see a pre-agricultural era where, quote, civs won't be able to found cities at the beginning of the game. They'll be able to explore the land around their spawn, however. Civs won't be distinguishable from each other at this point. If you happen upon another unit, they'll be a generic nomad or some such label. Warfare at this stage would be difficult. Once a civilization is founded, individual nomadic tribes become these civilizations. They were initially selected / were given. He goes into the more details about talking about having different food and production pools. Depending upon where a unit ends its turn, it may be able to then add more to its production or hammer pool. They can use the abilities to consume food and hammers in exchange for benefits. Production is primarily used to unlock tech innovations that may improve a unit's ability to survive. So, for example, a hunter that begins his turn on top of sheep or furs may spend production and the rest of its movement to develop cloth and clothing, which give units a 25% defense bonus against attack and allow them to enter snow tiles. I'd like other tech innovations, but I can't really think of any good ones. Perhaps more to develop culture, like jewelry or art or something. Artistic expression is obviously much older than this time setting. And one of the more interesting capabilities is that units may consume food to produce more units. For example, either another hunter or gatherer. What I actually like is subsequent conversation, which is, and to me my kind of take was, so you're going to play this mini game within the game. Because then once you settle the tribe, then everything that you were doing before is now past. You can't do that anymore. We've got this divide between agrarian society versus pre-agrarian society. Whereas some people tried to say, even once you found a city, why could your civilization not then have components of both agrarian and quote-unquote pre-agrarian, where, for example, kind of took it that these nomadic civilizations kind of remind a bit of colonies in Civilization 3, where you would be able to, for instance, camp on a particular resource, and then you have access to that resource, but it was vulnerable for someone to coming along and going, squish, you know, I want to found a city here, squish, I'm going to force my unit, my technologically superior unit, onto this tile, and you're not going to have the benefit to that anymore. To me, so long as it's not just, let's have pre-civ and then play-civ, so long as there's some kind of holdover from what you have in the pre-agricultural era, just like certain decisions you make in the ancient era in Civilization 5 right now, it's not like, for example, okay, you've got this scout unit, and you're going to help scout the land, and then once you found a city, the scout unit is gone. Or say in Civilization 4, oh, bye-bye scout and bye explorer, you don't have that anymore. No, there might be times where you actually want to be able to continue to use these units to get benefit to food, production, maybe even gold and culture. Some people say we've got to be able to incorporate that there, maybe even science, so that you can have a combination of those two, or you can, strictly speaking, decide for yourself, once I am able to found an agrarian society, I'm done.
I know, it struck me as sort of a very sort of kind of wildly swingy mechanic that's basically, it's going to have the effect of delaying some civs' founding dates of their first city relative to others, because essentially, the way it's described, you're not going to have that much luck trying to attack random units, and you wouldn't know who you were attacking even if you did. So most people will be trying to build up as many units as possible, gather as much food as possible and food and hammers to get their first settler out and actually start being able to advance in their technology. And basically, the first person to settle is likely to be the person who's got pretty good odds to win, because if you're starting 10 or 20 turns after that, then you're in a bit of a handicap situation there.
To me, it's almost even a minor grander consideration of, do I settle on turn zero, or do I move around some more to find a better spot?
Well, I think the way it's described, it sounds like the best move would be to find a decent food tile for your hunter or gatherer, sit there to gather enough food to make more hunters or gatherers, and there'll be some sweet spot where you're gathering enough food per turn that you're best off to wait for the settler next. But the idea would be to trade off between gathering food and hammers and exploring the map, but it just seems like you'd want to save the exploring for after you'd actually founded your city, and also I suspect the sweet spot number might be somewhere around 6, because at 6 you can gather your 6 units around your settler so that they're not disappearing and becoming barbarians, which he had described later in the post, that once you've found your city, you've got 3 turns until any units outside your borders will become barbarian. Then you'd be smacked by maintenance costs, so maybe not as many as you can, but certainly as many as practical.
Yeah, that part actually struck me in particular as something that I wouldn't want because, okay, you want to be nomads. You want to be able to explore. I'm going to kind of set aside the realism aspect here in great part. I want to find where other civilizations are. I want to find where better land is that I might want to settle a permanent community and then grow that particular community. I've now settled a community. You better all get back here or you turn into barbarians. That, to me, is also part of the hard switch. It's like, okay, I've turned the switch off with this pre-game game, whereas I like the idea of not only would you not get a penalty for not bringing them back in, but it could be a supplemental, smaller bonus, like a secondary bonus, like having a colony in Civilization 3, where, not saying you're going to want to use this over the course of the entire game, but you don't want it to be able to say, well, it's almost always going to be that as soon as you settle the city, you are done. I guess you can get into questions of, do we really want to have this combination? Are we just making it more complex for complex sake? We want to make it fun, but I think it's something that can be explored to be made fun, which kind of comes up subsequently in the thread, just so long as, again, it's not just a game within a game, and then that's the end of it. That would suck to me.
Well, I mean, you could make it that it's a scenario. You can just chop it off and call this first part a scenario, and then you can blow up the map so that your nomads aren't wandering faster than your tank. So you just blow up a section of a map and then find a space within there, within your little mini game to settle, and then it would actually collapse the map into the actual game map. I mean, you could do that, but then there wouldn't be other civs wandering around the same map. And in theory, you probably should never be running into another civ per se, because then you're started way too close and you both become civs and you find out you're on border right away. And
yeah, that, yeah, you're 3 tiles from Monty.
Yeah, see, that would prevent you from being like, I'm going to play the bulk of this game as pre-agrarian, and by pre-agrarian, I mean not settling a permanent city. But yeah, then as soon as you run up against someone, it's either, oh, they're also pre-agrarian, or even worse, oh, they've already settled a spot, and now I'm particularly vulnerable to being squished. Let's get out of here.
Yeah, well, that's why I would suggest it'd be more of a scenario type that can be skippable, so that you could use it to do it, but then the outputs of it would lead into your actual game. Like somebody said at the bottom, agriculture is not necessarily the only way towards civilized life or permanent settlements. There could be a few extra ways of getting to that point, and then those choices define how you start in the actual game. So that you could play, say, Japan and do a bunch of sea-based stuff and maybe start with sailing instead of agriculture and go that way.
You were mentioning something about to have a secondary sort of smaller map or something to work within this pregame thing. Everything really has to be on the same map or else you're just kind of distracting from the game. It kind of gets a bit confusing for the player, I would have thought.
Well,
but,
so
yeah,
the whole point behind this is getting away from the game, right?
I think the appeal to me, at least at the outset, was sort of the idea that you get the chance to explore the map beforehand. And it's sort of got a trade-off with the looking for food thing, but I don't think it's particularly done well in the sense it probably would be better if you ran out of food in certain spots, so you were sort of forced to keep moving on rather than just plonking your guys down on decent food sources and just leaving them there while you build more.
Yeah.
But yeah, as an idea for giving you, I don't know, 20 or 30 turns to explore your surroundings, this seems reasonable, but as described, I'm not that sold.
Yeah, I don't mind the early searching, because obviously you're going to know more about your starting area than you really should. I mean, as a function of early explore, sure. Somewhere in there, there's talked about movable resources like cows and horses and stuff like that would run around. I kind of like that concept, because then, you know, if you get to the quote-unquote animal husbandry tech, then you would actually lock down that resource in the tile rather than following them around. So if you have a horse resource, you can follow them around and get horse units.
Interesting. Although then you lose sight of the horses for a little bit until you get your animal husbandry again.
Yeah, invisible horses just don't make sense to me.
So they're actually unicorns.
Yeah. Yes. Because then you could possibly also modify your local map area at the same time.
Possibly. That's an interesting idea. So I don't know how you'd do it with the some of the resources, but certainly with the animals, sort of you could imagine herding them and dragging them into place, although then you'd be sort of running the risk of, like, people making ridiculously good starting locations. But then again, the more time you spend on dragging your animals around, the less time other people have already settled their city. So maybe it's an interesting trade-off.
Yeah.
Could be an interesting idea.
And of course,
capital at the expense of time.
Yeah, or you eat them all and it's too late.
I like the concept, but the devil is definitely in the details.
Yeah.
It could be a lot of one step forward, two steps back, and in the practical world of game development, we only have so much time in a development cycle to look at such things to then decide, are we still going to commit the time and the resources to this? Is there enough here? I think there's enough to get started, kind of like what LP and Matt have been getting at. Do I see in the thread, yes, we're at a point now where this sounds like a plan to actually put into place to practice to see if it is fun? No, but I think there's enough there to get us started. Drew Zane in the chat says, I think the suggestion here is way too complex and will make new players be less interested in Civ.
Yeah.
As much as I've been pro-exploring this, I think you could also make some existing players of Civ not want to pick up the next title if you do this. So you have to be very, very careful when you're going to be tinkering with something that is so fundamental as the starting game. And if you're going to do that on paper, does this look like fun? And if it doesn't look like fun on paper, then it's probably not going to be fun in practice. But I think with a little more finesse, it would be worthwhile to try. Thread starter here was a dunk. He said, I don't want to do it like mods have done it because of this issue, and that issue, and that issue. Well, maybe, in fact, we perhaps should be looking at those mods a little more in particular and about why this works or why this does not work, because some people have already done some of the work to see if this can work and how could it work in-game.
And obviously, just make it optional. Seriously. Just make it default off and people can turn it on.
Default off, you go into the normal Civ game, but this is an option if you want additional challenge or bonus.
I was totally mentioning this as just some sort of mod-type thing, or perhaps just a checkbox-type option. Not the default experience, I think. By its nature, Civ, well, you've had five games now where you're starting with your settler and maybe a worker or something, and maybe a warrior, but the whole settler start thing is sort of ingrained now, so I don't think you can change that in the base game, but maybe you can have an option for people who want to play with a bit of flavor.
If we're going to do this, then let's actually do this. I wouldn't want it to be, we're going to have it in the game, but let's just have it an option that you can toggle on or off. Can we get to the point where it's going to be reasonably fun for most players, however we're going to define that? And I hear the argument about, well, we're going to change something so fundamental as what we've been used to in five games. Some people said that about, and I know I'm kind of going out there when I say this, but there were these things called hexes that were avoided. Oh, no, this is going to be too complex. No one's going to like that. I can't imagine going back to squares. Honestly, now, am I saying that this is going to be successful or this is worthwhile simply because of that comparison? No, I'm just not ready to write it off as something that either you're going to have it in the game and then it's an option you can toggle on or off. I would rather see it not be in the game at all than have that option toggle on or off.
Well, then you suck.
That is a brilliant counter-argument, 10-year-old. I applaud you.
The only way to do it properly is to make it optional.
It optional, but on by default, and I think that would be reasonable.
Yeah, either way. It doesn't matter one way or another, as long as it's optional.
Because you can, disable barbs and stuff if you want, or anything, really. So, it wouldn't be inappropriate to have it as a toggleable option.
Although, his whole concept of barbs would not exist until
you settle. Well, I know, but I'm just saying, as an example of the current game state, there are long-standing Civ traditions that you can just straight disable if you want.
I think there is potential for a pre-4000 BC start. You know what I'd like? Not a 4000 BC start, because civilization started long before 4000 BC.
Imagine with a 4001 BC start.
Wah, wah, wah.
Ha ha. Snark.
My main thought, actually, on if this was something that was in the default game, then you'd run into the issue of how do you make this pre-game variable enough that it's feeling different each time? Because the whole thing with starting with a settler that you can found a city with is that you immediately have the decisions of what am I building, what am I researching. Whereas if you're just moving units around the map, I mean, a little bit there, but I don't know if it's enough that you'd want to be doing that every single game.
So that's why I would think that we'd have to change some of the ancient era stuff as well, so that agriculture is not the tech that you technically start with, that there would be alternates and alternate paths into it, that you maybe not even need agriculture whatsoever if you're on an island that has a lot of
fishing and sailing.
Yeah, not agriculture. You'd also have to make it so that those choices matter to the main game. So maybe you get to being a Civ via sailing, but without agriculture, a lot of that say, construction and other passive societal agri life sort of stuff just is not as easy to get as if you went sailing.
What you do in the early game maybe gives you a bonus of some sort, such as a civ flavor or something.
Oh, you don't even choose civs anymore. Haha, you just start with a person, and then you have to build your way up in where you start and what you do defines what civ you got.
So if I start on an island and I take fishing, I'm suddenly Japan.
This I like, not necessarily specifically, I do like some of the specifics. This is the type of the conversation where it's, okay, how do we make it so that it is not a pregame, but it actually is within the game itself? We want it to be able to feel like it is as seamless a transition as possible, where you're completely pre-agrarian, and then you have agrarian, but then I would also like to see, again, back in some respects, that the pre-agrarian, you don't have to continue using it, but you can continue using it, just like you have considerations of, okay, once you get to turn 10, wherever you are now, you now must settle. No, you want to be able to have it so that there are potential good things and bad things that can happen depending upon when in the cycle you decide that you want to go from pre-agrarian to agrarian and then have some kind of hybrid or not. This is good. This is what I'm getting at. Exactly.
You might want caps on those food and production pools, because otherwise somebody's just going to sit there and mine a bunch so they can like start an instability strip when they put down their city.
We would totally throw away stuff like that. Totally throw that out. There would have to be a way for defining how you got to things. Like, maybe it's all about what you do. If you spend a lot of time around horses and sheep, then you would push more towards animal husbandry and maybe some civ that has benefits towards horses. And if you spend more time around plantationable things, then you move towards more agricultural style of stuff. Or if you just run around constantly, maybe you just turn into, like, Chaka, because you don't know how to settle.
What you're doing in the early game has consequences, good and bad, for what then happens past that particular point, that it can all come back to, oh, it actually did matter what I did from turn 0 to 10, because this, that, and that. It could be something really small for over the course of the entire game, something really significant at the beginning of the game that then has a lasting effect, something that you just can't say, okay, well, those 0 to 10, we've been there, done that, now let's get on to the quote-unquote real game. If that's how this is going to be treated, then don't treat it at all. Let's not even start.
Yeah, impacts matter. But maybe, you know, you find a natural wonder. Gods are in there. And you start with polytheism.
Jerzan in the chat. First, you built a wonder. Would you like to be Egypt?
Yeah.
Oh, I know. You founded a city on the coast. Would you like a trade agreement with England? No. Or you killed a city-state. Would you like to be Dan the Mongolian? Drew, why would I kill a city-state? I can't bully them for their gold anymore. What are you talking about? That seems suboptimal.
You have to bully.
Guys, did you know Civ is 25 years this year? There are players that are younger than the game series.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of scary. But anyway, yeah. DICE is going on in Las Vegas. They had a panel up there with students and others to talk about it. There's a couple of videos, but there's also an article one, too, that's going through things. And what was the stat on here? There's how many played hours? 1 billion hours played? That's just that we know of, I guess, and Steam has been monitoring it.
Yeah.
Because I thought, I think that's a little too low.
Now, we want to be really technical, back to stuff we've talked about before. The game has been active for more than a billion hours. Now, whether you're actually playing the game.
Oh, yeah. Certain Solomon, he was just, like, technically on 24-7 for a little while there, yeah.
Because he fell asleep at the computer and never went back to it.
33 million sales to date, including 8 million for the latest Civilization V. And I'd seen comparable metric discussions before, but with all the variations and computations across consoles and mobile, 66 versions of the game across all platforms. Whoa. Okay, then.
I was just fascinated by the fact that the average playtime on Steam is over 150 hours. It seems quite high, given that there must be quite a high proportion of people who just...
Skewing going on there, because average is problematic.
The average is like...
Sure. People that put it for 2 minutes, and then the rest of us that have 1,000 hours, and it's kind of skewed.
I'd rather the median, to be honest, but still is a thing. DICE, Design, Innovate, Communicate, and Entertain, from the Academy of Interactive Arts and Sciences. We had Sid Meier, and if you don't know who Sid Meier is...
Why are you listening to the scene?
Yes, thank you. co-founder and director of creative development of Firaxis. We've got Brian Reynolds, the chief creative officer of Big Huge Games, resurrected Big Huge Games. Soren Johnson, CEO and design director of Mohawk Games. And Bruce Shelley, who in the graphic behind is just described as a 2009 AIAS Hall of Fame inductee. But he also kind of had something to do with the original Civilization.
A little something.
Co-designer was said. I'm kind of surprised they didn't emphasize that a little bit more. But Bruce Shelley served as the moderator for this panel for Sid, Brian, and Soren. The VentureBeat article was pretty good. I also had a chance to watch the video as well. There were a lot of things that were discussed in this that have been discussed time and time again, most recently at Firaxicon. But if you're interested in what the topics were throughout, introduction of each of the gentlemen in the industry, the metrics which we've touched upon, how Civilization came about, change in designer for each subsequent iteration, talked about that. They talked about Civilization Revolution for all of two sentences, so I kind of almost hesitate to put it as a separate topic, but it kind of was. Why does Civ remain popular? Principles of design, impact of modding capability, the cheat menu was brought up. Hey, Sid, remember he had the cheat menu available right from the outset there? Yeah, about that. Lessons making Civ carrying forward and standout quote-unquote wow moments. Lessons making Civ carrying forward. Sid mentioned about, you know, the series of interesting decisions. We saw that before. And Brian Reynolds says,
Civilization II happened relatively early in my career, and it's always ever after been the standard against which I compare myself. I'm always thinking, you know, am I ever going to do a game as cool as Civ II was?
But he said, in terms of weird lessons, this was a Civ lesson.
Whenever you're going to change a number, you need to double it or cut it in half. No kind of half-assed 10% stuff. And that's a really good rule because it makes sure you can tell that you've had an effect, first of all. If you can't even tell you had an effect when you double it, you need to just go double it again. Kind of stick by that and make sure we understand what that variable even does.
When he made that comparison, I immediately thought of recipes. I wonder what happens if I double this.
Oh, God.
Interesting amount of flour.
You will find out what the effect it has actually had. Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Suddenly your cookies are flat? Well, that's your problem.
Let's take out the gluten. Okay, yeah, I went there.
Yeah, it's a rice flour cookie.
Totally.
Soren Johnson said,
come up with an idea, and I want to design it, and I make it too complex at the beginning. A good example for that would be the way religion worked originally in Civ 4, this black box where I had all these kind of interesting calculations going on about how religion spread. You know, it spreads by trade routes, and if you have similar cultures, and if you build temples near each other, and all these calculations were hidden. They were all sort of inside of the machine.
Like, sounds really cool.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, oh, listen, I'm being so clever, you know? But, like, you know, the player's response was just like, we don't know what's going on. I'm just either going to ignore it or get frustrated.
But he also said,
at a certain point, your community understands your game better than you do.
Mm.
Mm. Yes.
Yeah.
You're never going to be able to play the game nearly as much as your community does. So listen to them and take what they say seriously. Try to expose it to people outside your company as early as possible.
Yeah, that's totally true. I had that quote marked down as well, just because as you're designing the game, you're spending majority of your efforts into improving the code and the graphics and so on, but your players are the ones who are constantly playing this thing way more than you could ever possibly play it, so they're always going to find the little kinks and things that you're never going to even get the chance to see, so yeah, you're only going to learn by listening to what they've got to say.
It's like, we spent the last couple of weeks trying to figure out this animation sprite problem. Isn't that great?
Mm-hmm.
Listen, if it's not the Sprite I can drink, I don't really care. I just want to play the dang game. Oh, okay, sorry.
Yeah, and there's plenty of other developing companies that could learn from the fact that the players should have fun, not the developers. Paradox, I'm looking at you.
And by that, Mackie means Paradox is going to tell us what company Mackie is thinking of.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, of course.
Sure.
Exactly what
yeah. We have brought up a certain game of theirs multiple times as an example of don't do this.
And Sid gives credit to the community. The community sustained the game with a lot of extended conversation about modding, and Soren talked about having so that the code with Civilization 3 and then especially Civilization 4 modders could actually go in there and figure out, easily look at the pieces and then experiment. So you could actually see the values, and then, you know, you could try this doubling and having effect to see what would actually happen.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, it's the benefit of giving the players the ability to extend the life of the game means that you don't have to constantly spam out yet another one, which means that you can take your time to build the next one.
But that goes against EA's business model. I mean,
Phil said it.
Activision? Call us spam?
Well, there are a few offenders here, yes.
Madden.
On Civilization 2,
we didn't really know how to do a sequel back then, and so we had to figure out, well, what is a sequel to a game where you're not continuing the story with some characters, because it was the entire history of the world, and it was the characters and events that you made. So we kind of came down to, well, we're going to just try to improve lots of little things and maybe take things that had been sketched in broad strokes before and fill them out a little bit, or take small suggestions from the internet. And it made it a really hard game to demo for somebody, because you couldn't really get anybody that wasn't a gamer to understand how cool this was going to be.
And then that's where your community comes in, because they then become your advocates, and they're able to tell, we like this game, we think it's cool, and we don't actually work for the company, so sadly we're not going to be getting any of the profits if you decide to buy the game. We're telling you it's cool, because we play this game. And why do we play this game? This reason, that reason, and that reason. Oh, by the way, this is how the game can be made better.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Everybody's got their own opinions on how to change it and make it the way that they want it.
Yes.
That's what we have mods for.
Exactly. Yes. I appreciated actually that Sarin was sort of talking about the different styles of playing, as mentioned, the Succession games and the Pit Boss and even the Democracy games, which was interesting, because in my experience that's sort of more of a thing where people will play the players and not the game.
Yeah.
So much. Yeah. But I definitely miss Pit Boss and Survive, miss those sort of 10 to 18 or more player games. I hope they'll bring back something similar to that for Civ 6, so focus a bit more on the multiplayer, but we'll see, I guess.
Oh, we can just see it now. Civilization 6, multiplayer only.
Yeah. Oh, God.
Totally. Straight to the Call of Duty model. Go, go.
I can hear some people saying, that's Civilization Online, Dan.
No.
Oh, right.
No, no, but you can do it. You just have it all set up as per multiplayer, and then, you know, if you don't know anybody, then the AI can fill in. But it's all still one interface.
They did have Civ World a while back as well, the Facebook one.
Let's not talk about that.
Can I pretend that didn't happen?
Yeah, about that.
Yeah, I remember. I tested for that game.
At least from a business perspective, because it's like that was the first and to date only Civilization game that was canceled. At least, okay, that Civilization game that we know of was canceled. Somebody was going to be like, hey, Dan, what about that dinosaur game Firaxis was going to do? Okay, that...
Dan, you have an obsession with the dinosaur game.
Civ game?
Was the dinosaur game a Civ game? Oh, let's go back to that design decision to start with the old pre-agriculture. You could start with the dinosaurs instead.
Yeah.
There you go.
And what killed them off changes between games.
Yeah.
I remember a funny little thing in 1995 when we were making Civ 2. We would get really concerned. People would come around and tell you, if you don't capture the user's attention in the first hour of the gameplay, you're really in trouble. So that's what 1995 was like. These days, it's like the first 3 seconds or something.
Oh, come on.
Come on, Brian. It's at least 5 seconds. Jeez.
Goldfish have 8. Humans only have 7 now. Although, I don't think anybody with a 7-second attention span is really going to play Civ in the first place.
Yeah. Can't sit still for that long.
I think they would play Civilization many times, just for not very long. Oh, let's play this game. Oh, this is lots of fun.
I settled the city.
Let's play this game. This is fun.
I settled the city. I settled the city. New game. I settled the city.
Seren was talking about the large appeal of the Civ games and the fact that you've got the overlapping goals with, I need to get ironwork in, but the pyramids is underway, I just want to finish the pyramids, but, now I'm just about to capture Paris, now let's do that, and sort of the fact that there's never really a good moment to put down a game of Civ, so, yeah, you're always...
He's getting right outside again, guys, what happened?
Yeah.
What the hell is this white crap?
This is just the sort of thing, everyone loves being the leader of their own world, and my personal approach is sort of, how many wonders can I sort of force out before I actually end up dying?
Yeah, what a surprise. We haven't played with you before, I don't know that.
Just so you know, like, Turncast lore still includes, you're parkening it when you don't go after your AI opponent in multiplayer and sit back and build wonders, just so you know.
Yeah, good to know that's a good legacy.
Hold on after 6 or 7 years.
It's good to have a legacy.
Support the ongoing Polycast Patreon campaign.
Collective achievements.
Personal incentives.
Month-to-month commitment.
For more information, visit thepolycast.net/Patreon.
Call in today.
In North America, 301-637-7659.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
Log on to the series' official website at
thepolycast.net.
Yes, well, this has been episode 249 of Polycast. With me is the usual suspects, Dan Q.
I'm always the suspect.
Yes, yes, you are. I play too much Town of Salem. Me and team.
I claim N.O.
Madjin.
I claim O.M.
And our guest and longtime Turn Cast player, Lord Parkin.
Thanks, let's do it again in another 6 years.
So, Lord Parkin wants the show to continue for at least that long again so he can return to the show.
Yeah, I'm going to come back 16 anyway.
Well, we are on schedule to go at least another 10 years based on a previous episode, so there is that.
Okay, Mackie, at least another 11.
What? Yeah.
That's true.
Is this going to be a thing like the next time Madjin is going to do a SIF 5 LP and every time somebody mentions it, it goes out like another 6 months?
We will never stop.
I put in the chat, waiting a little bit more on a regular co-host to buzzing. It's good to hear you're all regular.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, we're going there already, huh?
That's a good start today already.
Kids, this is Mr. Quick. It was the first time I was ever introduced to anybody as Mr. Quick, and I kid you not, I turned around to look for my dad. And I turned around, I was like, oh, I actually said, oh, me, yes, that's me.
Did the introduction involve anything particular?
Yeah, actually it does. It involves you reading your credit card number out loud.
Okay. Alright. Also the CC code.
We would prefer you read that out loud before going live, though. That way only we have access to it.
Yeah. Alright. Yeah.
No, people who listen to the live stream are completely trustworthy, LP. You don't have to worry about it.
Yeah. Alright.
Cool.
Of course.
Just like that Nigerian prince I met the other day.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you met him? That's impressive. I've heard from them many times, but I've never actually met one.
The Buzzing wants to know, you do make the guests listen to an episode before they do it, right? Make them?
Actually, I would like to know how to do that. I could use that as a reference for the future.
I don't know. Did you listen from the very beginning of the episode to the end, or did you just skip parts?
Oh, yeah.
What? Yeah, you listened to the whole episode, or yeah, you skip parts?
Yeah. No. I've listened to them all the way
through. Yeah.
I'm a horrible person, I know.
Okay, well, so speaking about horrible people.
The first topic has changed.
Wait, which one?
Speaking of change.
What?
What?
No, it's utility. It's the utility pantheon.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
I'm just messing around.
Phil.
Let's go.
Go.
Sid, actually, at one point when he was talking about Civ 1, he did say, there was, quote, no day zero patching, quote.
Yeah. Well, there was no ability to day zero patch unless he knew who bought the game before they even bought it and then mailed stuff to them. Although, on that note, there will be new Civ 5 LPs on my channel this year.
This year, quote.
December 31st.
No. I am officially.
I'm sorry. December 30th.
I'm officially promising one per month.
Qualifiers. Magic did not say which Civ title number one, nor did he talk about the length of said episodes.
It is true.
Well, speaking of faith, Mackie will spirit us away to the next topic.
Dan doesn't want me to keep going on that one.
Weird.
It was kind of politicasty territory, and...
Just talking history.
Like, yeah, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Have a good nap to Mackie.
Well...
I don't think Mackie knows which way she's going.
Mackie said no.
Mackie, are you muted? Again?
Son of a bitch.
Now, was that directed to the fact the microphone was muted or our panelists in particular? Just, you know.
The mute. I could have sworn I unmuted it a minute ago.
Recorded February 20th, 2016. Civilization 5 25th Anniversary Panel at DICE 2016, courtesy Polygon. Civilization 4, 5, and Beyond Earth Sound Clips copyright Take-Two Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.